Broadway musicals are never afraid to tackle taboo topics, but few are as deeply as entrenched in dark themes as Spring Awakening. A rock musical based on a 19th century German play, the show follows a group of teenagers discovering their sexuality in a dangerously repressive society. The critically acclaimed musical won 8 Tony Awards and pushed forward the modern idea of a musical with its non-traditional alternative rock score. This episode puts significant discussion of plot after the spoiler horn, and because of the serious themes of the musical, post-spoiler horn involved a conversation about sexual assault in media. I hope you enjoy this episode of Corner of the Sky. Hello! Today I'm excited to welcome onto the show my friend and fellow podcaster, Brian Hamilton.
Blah, 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 blah. Hi, Quinn.
Oh, you're so used to doing like the snappy incomparable introduction, so you have something prepared.
Yeah, I had something prepared, and I'm always trying to be snappy, especially when talking about one of my all-time favorite musicals.
Which is?
Spring Awakening. This show means so much to me. This wasn't the first show that I ever discovered on Broadway. That was Rent. But this one is up there in terms of hitting me at the right point in my life for me to really latch on to it.
Because Rent being people's first love has kind of been a theme on a lot of these episodes. But
I'm not surprised.
Tell me about your personal connection with Spring Awakening.
So my high school did this thing called Cabaret every so often, where it was like a theater-themed talent show, which was incredible. We always had people auditioning and doing really cool things to celebrate theater, do different things of theater. I was in it once. My friends and I did a skit from Avenue Q, one of the cleaner ones, thank God, but we did Avenue Q. I played Brian, because of course. And I remember, like, my freshman or sophomore year, this kid I really looked up to named Carl, who always got the lead in all the shows, and he was the coolest guy in school. He auditioned for Cabaret with Don't Do Sadness. And I never heard of Spring Awakening before, but when I heard it, the violins and the driving force of the song really spoke to me. And then he started singing, and he had this most amazing voice, and it was awesome. But he did the song, and it resonated so hard with me. And I thought, wait, this is from a Broadway musical? This is a song from a thing with a plot that this has to fit into? How does that work? And after that, like a few months later, I went out and bought this weird plastic disc. This was before streaming. I bought this weird plastic disc I had to insert into a player to listen to Spring Awakening. It was very weird. And it hit me then that this show has, you know, all the requisite parts of musical theater. It's got the book, it's got the score, it's got the lyrics, it's got the music, it's got the characters, it's got everything. But they don't interact with each other the way that traditional musicals do. And the reason Don't Do Sadness struck me so hard just on its own in a vacuum is that the soundtrack to Spring Awakening stands on its own completely as a really great pop rock album. And the songs don't play into the rest of the show the way they traditionally do. People are not singing about the plot and what's happening. There's no sung conversations in Spring Awakening. This is just characters, teenage characters, mind you, taking a break from whatever the hell they're doing to sing how they feel. And that's highlighted by the fact that this is an 18th century show using modern music and like completely breaking, like it's a very Brechtian thing to do, to like break what you're doing, break the fourth wall, and just sing your heart out. And that's what makes this musical so powerful and unique to me, is that the music stands on its own as a really amazing pop rock album, and it does really interesting things. All three versions of the show I've seen staged have done amazing, amazing, unique, different things from each other even. And it's one of my favorite things ever created for Broadway.
This show is something that really asks to be reinvented and reexamined every time that it's put on. And the whole point about that, the cast album is not the kind of traditional Broadway cast album. It's almost, you could almost consider it just as a rock album. And that's one of the reasons why I feel like I know Spring Awakening the least well of maybe any show that I've talked about for this podcast.
Really?
Yeah, because I've listened to the soundtrack, and there are a couple songs in there I really love.
And I've read the plot of what happens, because you cannot tell what's happening in that show just by listening to the music.
Oh, more on that later. That's my favorite thing about this show.
Yeah. But I, with everything else that I'm talking about for this podcast, either I've seen it or I feel like I've really been able to experience it in a significant way by listening to the cast album. But with here, like, I have this music and I have this plot, but it is divorced from each other in a way that's hard to put together if you're not seeing it performed.
Let's go back to the saga of young high school Brian discovering the show for the first time. I bought the weird disc that I had to insert into a player and listen to the soundtrack endlessly. And at this point, I have not changed since high school. I was still super spoiler averse and really, really didn't want to spoil myself for the show. So I listened. And I was like, huh, I can't really figure out what's going on. And then by the end song, Song of Purple Summer, I thought, wait, this is how the show ends? Wait, what the heck just happened? And it was then I realized, okay, I can listen to this and not know a single thing about the plot of the show. And it's magical to me to be able to listen and have this plot built up in my head about what happens, who the relationships are with each other, and figure out who is close with whom and what happens throughout the show. It was the coolest thing for me because at this point, I really fell in love with rock operas like Pink Floyd's The Wall and The Who's Tommy and things like that. And I love the idea that these are albums you can listen to all the way through and get a story. And that's kind of what set me off on Broadway in the first place. I found The Wall when I was in like eighth grade or so. Like, and by this point, when I was like knee deep in theater culture and figuring out all these different shows, and I heard Spring Awakening, I loved that I could listen to it and be like, okay, I don't know the plot to this because I want to be spoiler free for when I eventually see the show. But this music stands on its own as some incredible, incredible music. And The Wall stands on its own as a self-contained story. Like, you can listen to The Wall album, the 1979 one by Pink Floyd, and not have the context of the 1981 movie they made of The Wall or any of the other adaptations of The Wall they've done. And I really appreciated that The Wall was a standalone story, whereas Spring Awakening was a standalone album with kind of a story there. Like, I knew a few key points about the plot, but I also really understood that, like once I saw the show, the, like, act-ending sex scene is playing during a song you would never actually freaking expect the song to be. And it was mind-blowing for me to actually see the show finally and be able to put the pieces together with music I loved to characters I didn't know I loved yet.
Mm-hmm. There's only a few songs on the soundtrack that are particularly attached to the plot, like the one where Moritz is reading the letter, and there's a lot in there that is very particular to these characters and the plot of the show. But for the most part, the rest of the songs, like, could be songs on the radio, a radio that has no censorship rules, but still.
The other thing that kind of gives it away is the vocal arrangements, where there's like choruses of men and women singing songs along with the main artist, singer, person in the foreground of each song. And that really doesn't happen on the radio either.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into the music in particular. So this is a rock album and is written in this particular way that's not like most other Broadway cast albums. And the music itself, so I'm not as attached to this musical as you are. There are some songs on here that are some of my favorites of theater music, but I really wouldn't place this cast album in my top 10.
For me, it's in my top 10 simply because, I mean, I find it interesting that the reason you aren't so attached to it is the reason I am so attached to it, because I was able to listen without the context of the show because I hadn't seen the show when I found it. So I like that you approach Broadway shows and that all of these different aspects of the show are things you want to be a part of from the get-go. And for me, like, this is the same thing with me in Hamilton. I knew I wasn't going to be able to see the show forever, so I was like, okay, fine, I'll just listen to the Hamilton soundtrack, and I'm now, like, a Hamilton fan, part of that culture. Spring Awakening, on the other hand, like, there's none of that context. And that's what I love about it, is that you can give this to somebody. This would be, honestly, my introductory Broadway album to anybody, because I can give this to somebody and say, listen to this. This music's really good. Now go see the show if you can.
I guess for me, I consider listening to the cast albums an experience in itself, and I want to be able to understand everything that's going on in the show from that, because I mean, I've in the past few years, I've been really lucky in being able to see a lot of shows in Boston and New York. But for most of my life, I saw musicals on stage very infrequently. And so the Castoms were really how I experienced them. And while, you know, you always have, well, except for Sung Through musicals, but you most of the time you have scenes in between and then you have visual stuff that and then so there's this whole layer on top of it. But you still got the whole story and you could still feel like you knew it just by listening to it.
I will also acknowledge my privilege here in that I lived an hour and a half away from New York when I grew up, so it wasn't a far cry for me to see shows most of the time because I would be able to go into New York early in the morning, wait at TKTS or outside the theater, and be able to see a show for maybe $30 or $40 and be able to get there in only an hour or so, which was incredible because that's how I saw Book of Mormon, and I did that with a bunch of other shows too. My school would always do a Broadway trip every year to see a show and then go backstage and meet some of the people or like learn some of the dances from the thing, and that was really cool. But we wound up being very, very lucky in that we could see all of these shows we were listening to, and for me that meant I shouldn't listen to the soundtrack until I see the show.
First of all, I did not know you got to do that, and that is so cool.
You're going to cut out the bit about prom from the pre-show, but we had very different high school experiences.
That is really cool, though. And that's a good point, is if I have a musical that I know I'm going to go see, like if I've got tickets to it or I know it's coming near me, then I'm much less likely to listen to the cast album if I haven't already. Because, you know, then you get the full experience at once. So that's a good point, too.
I kind of wish, in recent years, I kind of wish that all the shows I've seen, I'd be able to go listen to the cast album beforehand, because when I saw Fun Home a few years ago, I loved it, and I'd only heard one or two songs from it overall, and I really wish I had more context, and like I could feel that swelling up of the song and know the context for each of the songs, say, okay, now this is when the last song of Act One is going to play. I should prepare for like a big ending or big plot twist or something. And I just never did that until very recently. And I really want to be able to do that more. Whenever I hear people, especially with Hamilton, whenever I hear people say, oh, I'm not going to listen to the show until I see it because I'm seeing it in a few months and it's going to be awesome, I get really, really angry.
Okay.
Because there are people that love the show and like know it inside and out and aren't able to see it.
Oh, yeah. Broadway isn't fair.
Broadway is not fair.
We've also touched on this, but haven't really got into it, about the other thing that really makes the music of this stand out is that it is rock. Like, that's not a normal... It's getting more normal, but it is still not usual Broadway fare.
This was still early enough in the pantheon of rock Broadway where it was unique enough to have this thing. And again, what's another unique thing that divorces the music from everything else in the show? The entire rest of the show is, for one, adapted from an 18th century German play, and two, portrayed exactly like that 18th century German play. It is teenagers from 18th century Germany, and it's incredible to see the difference between the rock music and Germany in this time before cell phones or before rock music or before anything. Like, the only mention of music in the show is playing piano in a piano lesson, and that's it. Like, there's no iPods, there's no boomboxes, there's no Spotify, there's no nothing.
But truly, this was the only way to capture the incredible amount of angst and pain that these teenagers are going through.
And another reason why the musical meant a lot to me was because, hey, I was a teenager. I was going through very similar angst. It was great.
It wasn't great.
No, it was not great at all.
But your life is not as bad as the people in this musical, though.
Dear God, no. And that's the thing. Like, even now, I was listening to the soundtrack on the way back here in the car for the first time in a while. And it was comforting is the really worst word for it. But it was like nice to be like, you know, I can still feel these emotions about, you know, looking for a job and stress and money and things like that. But at least I'm not, you know, in this position anymore like a teenager or in any of these other terrible situations that the characters get themselves into. And those emotions are what's universal.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is, of course, one of the things that make musicals in general as successful as they are, is even when they're about teenagers in Germany, we feel those same emotions and we're able to apply those thoughts and empathize with those characters in our own lives, even when on the surface we seem nothing alike.
I was never, you know, a starving artist in New York in the early 90s, but I still loved Rent for a long time.
I was about to say, I'm about to be a starving artist in New York, so there's that too.
Hey!
So back to Spring Awakening. Can you tell me a little bit more about these live performances that you got to see of this?
So again, I remained as spoiler-free as possible, and a bunch of friends of mine, we got like 10 tickets to this. We all went to see a touring production of, Broadway production, I believe, of Spring Awakening in New Brunswick, New Jersey, which was a lovely place. It was a state theater right by Rutgers. And we saw the show there for the first time, and I was giddy with excitement. This is up there with the first time I ever saw like My Chemical Romance or Nine Inch Nails, which is rare for a Broadway show because Broadway shows are... they're cut from the same cloth, but they're not exactly what you know in the score or soundtrack or anything like that. Whereas seeing a band is, you know, literally them. That's it. That's what you get when you see a concert. So that's what I loved about Spring Awakening is that I was still so excited, even though I knew this wasn't Lea Michele or Jonathan Groff. And I finally saw it. It was the Broadway touring production, and oh my God, my mind was blown. Like, the fact that the plot of the show was that, and the music was that, and that they married so well on stage, even if they don't on paper, that melted my head. It was great. Brief aside, I have a friend who grew up listening to the Rocky Horror Picture Show soundtrack from the time he was 4, and he didn't actually see the movie until he was 18.
Wow.
Can you imagine the brain melting of that situation compared to Spring Awakening?
What did he think it was? I don't want to get into that.
Me neither. Although I would like to point out the Rocky Horror connection to Spring Awakening. Touch Me and Touch A Touch A Touch Me are always right next to each other in my alphabetized music list.
I mean, there are definitely similarities to be drawn in the spirit of those shows.
Mm-hmm. So I saw that very first production and it was great. And then I saw a few years later, God, this... I no offense to this theater company that I'm not going to name, but they did a really terrible job. They had pre-recorded music on an outdoor stage in a park, and it was weird. The cast and the music didn't line up nearly as well as if it were live, which I feel like is a given, but that's just what they were able to do. And like all the performances were there, the music was there, the plot was there, everything was there, and they tried really hard, but it just didn't land. And that really made me sad. But it still reinforced the fact that I love the show, even if, you know, I was able to sit there and appreciate this really bad production. And it wasn't a good experience, but it made me feel good about the fact that I love this musical so much that I'm willing to tolerate it, even if in its worst form. And then I saw one a few months ago at a university, Monmouth University in New Jersey, and I had a friend who was a stage manager and got me front row tickets, which was mind-boggling. She knew I loved Spring Awakening. She was like, hey, you should come and see the show. It was great. And she said, oh, I'll get you a comp ticket. Oh, that's so sweet. I get it. It was in the front row. And their theater was... So the staging for Spring Awakening is very, very minimal and very, very interpretive. There's lots of chairs. No one ever really goes off stage. People just kind of sit down in the back and let things happen in the foreground, and it's great. There's always differentiations between the adult characters and children characters. The adults never actually interact with the characters in any way, but they sit on a upper platform usually and are completely separated from the rest of the characters, and all the adults are played by one man and one woman. And it's almost like Charlie Brown with a wah, 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 in that all the characters are just undifferentiated from each other. These are just the malevolent force of adulthood on children and teenagers and the patriarchy. And it's amazing to see that played out in the staging. So this was the best staging of Spring Awakening I had seen in this really great theater that was perfectly built for it. And I was in the front row for it. And it was stadium seating. It was so cool. And my favorite, oh God, this is a story I think I've told you, but I'll tell it on this show. I am very emotive, and I'm very, very into the things I'm into. I hope you can tell that from this podcast. And at intermission, I got a text from my stage manager friend. Hey, so everyone's talking about this one guy in the front row who's really into the show. Is that you? And I thought, oh, God, that's me. Oh, dear God, that's me. Oh, no. So, like, I didn't let up. because that's really hard for me to do. I have no chill. So during Act Two, I still emoted as much. I cried during all the crying parts, and I laughed during the laughing parts. And my favorite moment of this was in the unmentionable song that I cannot say the name of, when the part of the song where everyone goes blah, 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 and every single production of the show I've seen, everyone goes berserk and starts dancing, and it's this really great moment of F this, I don't care, because everything is so bad, and I'm just going to celebrate that. It's like leading right into how terrible things are. And the last chorus of the song ends with everyone going berserk and dancing, and the staging for this moment is my favorite staging of anything ever, and everyone's just dancing, and the lights go crazy, and the music goes crazy. The guy that played Melchior runs up to me in the audience and high-fives me when this happens. That's not supposed to happen.
You have been blessed. It just made me...
I had been blessed by Melchior Gabor, and oh my god, it was the perfect culmination of me singing Spring Awakening. And I don't think I'll see it again for a very long time, just because of how good this performance is and how incredible that moment was for me.
You've peaked. You've done it. Peak audience member.
Peak audience member. Never see a show with me, because I have no chill.
That's exactly why I want to see a show with you.
No, it's no fun. We do need to see Rocky Horror, though, because of that, because I have no chill for Rocky either.
Excellent. We'll make some plans.
Yes, yes. I'm sorry, what was the original question telling you about the different stagings I've seen? Do you have any other questions other than that big rant I went on?
Well, there was a lot there. We may come back to that at some point. But I want to talk about the Broadway productions. First of all, because the original Broadway cast of this musical features Jonathan Groff, Lea Michele, and John Gallagher, who I am all fans of from various different things, especially Jonathan Groff. But then I was looking at the Wikipedia page of Spring Awakening, and then I just happened to notice that Skylar Astin was in the original Broadway cast. And I was like, wait, what?
Who's Skylar Astin?
Okay. Skylar Astin of... Skylar Astin was Mark in the Rent Hollywood Bowl performance, various other things, and is one of the stars of Pitch Perfect.
Hey, waving through a window.
No, that's another guy.
Wait.
Okay.
Oh, wait. Dear Evan Hansen is the guy that I always get confused with Skylar Astin in Pitch Perfect, because they're the exact same person to me.
Okay, yes. Okay, so to be clear, Skylar Astin was Jesse in Pitch Perfect, who is the lead guy, and then his roommate was played by Ben Platt, who is now starring in Dear Evan Hansen on Broadway. I have no idea what Skylar Astin is doing right now, but it was just cool to see. But that surprised me, because I just didn't know that, and I like him, so... This bit has no purpose. I just wanted to express my surprise at that.
And remember when Lea Michele wasn't the person from Glee? That was weird.
Yeah. Remember when Lea Michele starred on Glee, and then they brought Jonathan Groff on to be her boyfriend, and it was incredible?
Remember when, like, my brain melted when that happened?
No.
Oh, well, it did. My brain melted, and I was very sad. I was really, really hoping John Gallagher Jr. would show up. He didn't.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
I also just admitted I watched Glee on a podcast. Dear God, what is this coming to?
Okay, to be fair, a lot of people watch Glee. It was on for, like, 100 years.
Yeah, I watched the first season and enjoyed it. And then I watched the second season because I was like, I'm a high school theater person, I have to keep watching it, and I stopped afterwards because I really liked the first one, and Ryan Murphy kind of ruins everything he touches after a while, so I was really upset that Glee went the direction it did, and I'm still upset American Horror Story is not as good as it is, because I want that show to be good, but it never is, because I watch the beginning episodes of every season because it's an anthology, and I want it to be good one of these seasons, and it never is. Sorry, that was a rant about Ryan Murphy. I watched Glee for a while.
That went on a journey. Back to Spring Awakening. So I don't think we have a lot to talk about in terms of the original Broadway performance, because neither of us saw it. But I do want to talk about the Deaf West revival, which mm-hmm. I did not get the chance to see. I tried to see it while I was in New York and it was happening, but I didn't get the chance to see it. But it is a really cool thing. So Deaf West Theater Company is a theater out in California who puts on performances of musicals that are done with hearing and deaf actors. And so my understanding of how it works is you'll have some characters that are now played by deaf actors in the show, and then sometimes they'll have a counterpart doing the singing for them, and vice versa. And it's very intermixed between hard of hearing characters and hearing characters. And a lot of their shows focus on accessibility. Like the Deaf West revival of Spring Awakening had the first actress in a wheelchair that was ever on Broadway. And apparently, sad I didn't get to see it, because apparently it was very, very good.
I've heard amazing things about it, and I tried to see it too. I was living in New York when this was on, and if there's any show to be interpreted in a way like this, it is Spring Awakening, because of how, because of the staging and because of the way it's written and created. Like, it is perfect to insert an element like this and make it work and make it really poignant, especially because, again, you're bringing modern sensibilities to such an old show. You're bringing accessibility to a modern show about an old show. There's so many different elements that can really make it work, and I'm really glad the show was as successful as it was.
Mm-hmm. It was revived on Broadway as a limited run, so they ended when they decided beforehand that they were going to end. But it did get nominated for a few Tony Awards, I believe, and generally across the board got positive reviews.
Mm-hmm. That's going to be awesome.
I know, I'm excited to see what the next Deaf West performance is, because I believe the previous Deaf West performance on Broadway was back in 2003, but I'm hoping that since Spring Awakening was so critically acclaimed that they'll get the chance to do another performance relatively soon. I don't know, I think Rent Deaf West could be pretty cool.
Rent would be really great. My first thought when I saw that they may be doing another show, hopefully, was Cats, because of how, again, interpretive.
Wait,
that it,
okay.
Shut up. Because of how interpretive it is and how weird it is to come together and how heavy dancing is in the plot of Cats, and I really, really appreciate that.
All right. First of all, there was a dramatic pause before you said Cats, and I was just waiting, and then it was like, okay. I haven't seen Cats. I cannot judge. I just wasn't expecting that.
I really, really, really don't want to admit that I really love Cats on a podcast. Again, I watched Glee and I love Cats. I'm a terrible Broadway person.
This is incredible.
Cats was my very first Broadway show. Cats was my very first Broadway show when I was in like first grade.
Oh my god, I've never seen Cats. I have heard a couple songs from Cats, because when we were kids, we had this giant CD set of like all the classic Broadway songs that exist, because that's a thing that we enjoyed as children. And so I have heard some of the songs from Cats, but that's the extent of it.
You're joking, but I think I have my Cats CD right back here.
Oh god.
I am holding in my hand right now the Cats Selections from Cats soundtrack CD.
Of course you are. This is okay.
So back to Spring Awakening.
So this is a friendly atmosphere, and there is no judgment here, and that is all I will say. So back to Spring Awakening. You mentioned before that you think that this was the perfect production to do a Deaf West revival of, and why in particular do you think that?
Because it's so broken down to its bare elements, like the staging and the music and the acting and the book. All of these different things stand on their own, and adding another element into that probably adds the least friction of any other thing. It'd be like adding any sort of extra element to a show. Like, it would work really, really well with Spring Awakening, especially with how dance heavy the show is. And I'm really excited. Like, I wish somebody filmed it, or maybe somebody did, but I would love to see how it was done, and adding like extra people involved to make it as effective as possible with all these extra elements and extra people doing different things and breaking the part of an actor down even more into people that are dancing and people that are singing or people that are hard of hearing and people that are not. Like, I really, really want to see how it was done.
Mm-hmm. I do think that they did perform at the Tonys, so there is a song or two that they did that you can look up online and watch, which is pretty cool.
Ooh, definitely looking that up.
Yeah. You gave a different answer than what I was expecting, because what I was thinking is that this that a Deaf West adaptation of it worked really well because of the content of the show, because the show is completely centered around these teenagers and all of the difficulties that they're going through in their life and the way that they're finding that the world is not built for who they are in a fundamental way. And I thought that the themes of accessibility and hard of hearing actors really added another layer to that and brought it into the modern day.
Ooh, I feel that. Is it bad that I love the show as much as I do and very rarely think about the content or plot of the show?
Like,
we were talking about Life is Strange the other day, and we talked a lot about how even though the things that happen in the game are not as ace as we'd like them to be, we still felt really, really good about it and bring those feelings with us. And as the other things fade away, that's what really sticks with us. That's how I feel about Spring Awakening in a way, that I love listening to the soundtrack and I love feeling the feelings I do when I watch the show or listen to the soundtrack, but I very rarely think about what happens. Every time I see the show, the ending is a little bit of a surprise to me because I kind of forget it.
Well, that's interesting. And that's actually a good point to talk about. What does happen in this show?
I forget. I only think about the feelings. That was okay. A joke.
Well,
that was a joke.
It's probably good. You want to block this stuff out. It is nasty.
It is pretty nasty and really intense. And it starts off with Venla Bergman, who is having a heart-to-heart with her mother about where babies come from. And it's like, it's this very sweet little scene that pays off in a very dark way at the end of the show. But it just, from there, ramps up to introduce all the other characters, what they're doing, their Latin class, all the school things that they're doing, and all the interactions that they have with their other classmates, and how segregated the school is between men and women. And it's, my favorite thing about the show is, as those kinds of things happen, sprinkled throughout are these really poignant, important songs, and very emotional songs that really hit in ways that you wouldn't expect for relatively mundane parts of a show, just like rising action. There's still incredible songs throughout there.
So as I mentioned before, I did not know the plot of this show before I looked up the Wikipedia page. All I knew is things that Jonathan Groff had mentioned in various clips that I've watched of him on YouTube, which I'm not going to dwell on, where that he mentions it at multiple points that he and Lea Michele have sex and John Gallagher is dead. And that's what I knew about this show.
I knew about half of that. I knew that John Gallagher died. That's the only thing I knew, because I love Don't Do Sadness so much. I had to look up the context and was like, okay.
I'm going to put this in the show notes. There is a video of Jonathan Groff reenacting the time he forgot the words to one of his songs in Spring Awakening. And is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. I've watched it so many times.
Oh my God. The show continues on, and the inciting action of the show is that Melchior gives Moritz a book of anatomy to learn about all the different things that are like haunting him at night, because, hey, teenagers. And that sets off a chain reaction of different things happening between him and Venla and all the other characters, and the relationships that develop between them and eventually become sexual. And that's the crux of the show, is that these kids are going through things they don't understand and nobody will help them. And they crush anybody that is trying to help them, which is why in the unmentionable song, Jonathan Groff is in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, one of the big points of the show is that these kids are becoming adults and they want to like explore sexuality and be, you know, humans, and then they have just no idea what is happening or like what they should do, and all of the adults in the world around them completely represses that in them until it ends in very, very bad ways.
One of the smoothest transitions from action to song in the show is a song called Touch Me, where it's not that like everything breaks and a rock song happens. It's a very soft rock song that happens in the middle of a very intense conversation between Moritz and Melchior. And I really appreciate that of the few times in the show that they do this, it's then when they really establish, okay, these kids have no idea what they're doing, but they still have those very sweet emotions about it.
I know that it's a story, but I feel so bad for them because, I mean, this is not speculative fiction. This is stuff that happened to real people, you know?
That's how it works. I mean, like, you feel for these characters that happen on stage because of all the staging, the music, the acting, everything really hits home what happens. Even if it is, you know, you're right, it's stuff that actually happened, but you feel so far removed a bit from it because it's 300 years later. Like, we're here looking back at what was happening in Germany at this time, and we're reinterpreting it and regurgitating it in a way that makes modern audiences tick, which is great.
300 years?
I think so. Wait. Oh, have I been saying 18th century? It's 19th century. I get century and, like, actual year now, because, like, we're in the 21st century now, but we're in the 2000. I'm sorry. It's 200 years.
So I just took a second. I was like, wait, that doesn't sound right.
Hear ye, Melchior Gabor. I am colonial now because I'm 100 years early.
Great.
I was wrong. I'm sorry.
This is a show that includes some really serious, dark content. And I guess I will defer to your judgment on this because, again, I haven't seen it in its full depiction. But it's just kind of like really bad things happen and then everyone is really depressed about it. And I feel like the show doesn't really attempt to process through these things that are happening, to reconcile them in any way. Or I know that there is a scene in which, well, in apparently in the off-Broadway performance, it was pretty clearly a rape. And then when it moved to Broadway, it was made, like, much more ambiguous, but still very iffy over whether it was consensual or not. And from my perspective of what I know about the show, it doesn't really deal with that in any way.
Are you talking about The Dark I Know Well?
Yes, I think so.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I remember when I first heard that song, it hit me in a way that was like, it's about child abuse and about sexual abuse. And there's a lot of, they sing the song about all the terrible things that are going on. And again, yeah, they're singing about the terrible things that are happening, but they're not processing them. And you know how I feel about this with Black Mirror and everything. I hate when shows try to be emotionally manipulative to make a point or don't give you a reason to feel those emotions. I would argue, even though I think the ending traipses into that territory a little bit, the ending of Spring Awakening is at least justified because of the point the show is trying to make, rather than this one scene that talks a lot about child abuse. And my other bugbear with Broadway shows is when scenes only exist for songs, and there's like maybe 3 or 4 lines of dialogue to establish, hey, we're here, how are you feeling? Oh, I'm not feeling so well. Oh, tell me about it. And then the song starts. In all this, well, I mean, not even the stagings. In the script, that's how The Dark I Know Well happens. It's just a scene of everyone playing. Somebody notices a bruise on a character, and they go, what is that? Oh, nothing, it's nothing. And then she sings The Dark I Know Well. And I hate when there's not enough context for a song, because it just feels like they wanted to put this song in because it's a good song. And yeah, musically, it's a good song, but it's such a hard song to listen to.
I will say, after you started talking, I realized that's not what I was talking about, but that is a very important part as well. I was talking about, I believe, when Melchior and Wendla have sex. That's not a consensual scene.
Oh my God. Really?
Oh man. Oh, this is news. Okay. Well, because again, I'm experiencing this through the Wikipedia page. In the production, at least this is on the Broadway production, she cries out against it, and in the off-Broadway run, it was, like, definitely non-consensual. And then as it staged on Broadway, apparently, as I'm going to just read this quote, Wendla still objects to Melchior, but gives in without understanding what he is actually trying to do, leaving the question of consent still ambiguous on many levels.
I am very upset that I didn't catch that in all my watchings of it, especially because this is what I was talking about earlier. The song is so happy and joyous. And that is what throws me off about that scene, because it's like, okay, I guess this is what's happening here. And it's still, you know, that's awful. Wow.
I guess that really means that this is very ambiguous in the productions that have been put on. If you can watch it and not even realize that it's implied that this might not be consensual. that does reinforce what my perception of it before is, like, the show doesn't attempt to deal with that.
Exactly. They just kind of put it there and not reconcile that. It's almost like the recent movie Passengers, where there's a lot of non-consensual things in there that haven't been dealt with in the movie, and the movie got a lot of flack for that. I feel like, especially now thinking about the ending and how by the end of the play, Jonathan Groff makes it a, like, personal journey for him to go back and be with Venla despite all the terrible things that he incited with the death of Moritz. It's terrible to me to think that those kinds of things are founded on such a non-consensual place.
This frustrates me when media does this, because it's one thing to have these incredibly serious depictions of rape and suicide in this production, but it's another thing to just have those happen and to not do something as a production on a larger level to deal with them, and to, like, and to what I would hope for in this case, to actually, as a show, condemn this rape.
I agree. And as for other aspects of the show like this, there's it's not justified for this to be in the show. I feel like other things like Moritz's suicide have at least the fallout you would expect in the show to put something as damaging and horrific in a show like this. At least there's more fallout for that, which is, you know, terrible considering they just kind of leave the rape hanging there. And at least, you know, the other terrible things in the show come back at the end and make the ending of the show a bit more poignant. Because at the end of the show, everyone's dead and terrible things have happened. And the songs that are sung are the ending of the show and the point of the end of the show. They don't reconcile the end of Act One at all.
I will say about this depiction of sexual assault, the point of why it is non-consensual in the show is that, like, Wenla in the show, she doesn't really understand what sex is. She doesn't understand what any of it means. And Melchior knows more than she does. And so it makes sense for the characters. And again, this was certainly a thing that did happen to people and still happens to people, is the imbalance between partners and horrible things that can happen from that, especially on this drastic of a level. But I just wish that the show had dealt with that better.
I agree. This is something I've said about Game of Thrones before. Things can't exist in bubbles like this. And as much as I love the show and want to say, oh, this was like the 19th century, people didn't have the kind of coping mechanisms that are there today or the kinds of communication people have today, but it's still not okay. And especially the fact that this exists now when people can cope with things like this, or at least talk about it, or at least make sure it doesn't happen in the best case. The fact that they created the show in, what, 2007, 2008 is kind of upsetting.
And it is interesting how they originally presented this as, like, an explicit sexual assault and then changed it later so it would be like there would be a question of consent, but it was much more like a relationship between the two people. And that's just, that kind of weirds me out. It's like, you can't just change that.
I agree. And given the fact that I didn't read the show as such until just now is really telling of that. And because I latched onto the fact that later on the show, Venla truly does love Melchior. And they didn't give that character the justice she deserved in knowing that. In fact, they kill her. Like, that's the extent to which they don't address what happened. I want to talk a little bit more about the soundtrack, because as much as I talked about how much it means to me, I haven't talked about why it means that to me. A lot of the songs are just so timeless in ways that you don't really get for other shows. And a lot of other shows, yeah, you'll know that they are Broadway songs just by listening to them. And yeah, listening to this, you can hear the vocal arrangements and the way that they're sung. And you can probably tell Broadway, but given Duncan Sheik, you probably wouldn't know. I love that a lot of the songs can mean anything, to the point where I don't know, I didn't know what different songs meant, and they changed the order of the soundtrack slightly, so I knew Moritz died at the end of Don't Do Sadness. But I also, immediately after that is The Guilty Ones and Left Behind, two very sad, somber songs, but on stage, The Guilty Ones opens up Act Two, and you never piece together why that is until you see the show, which is why I really love that The Guilty Ones is such a sweet, sad song after the sex scene, the rape scene, rather, and you have these moments of kind of soft, quiet contemplation until the end of the song when there's this crescendo of everybody singing about how they hate their bodies and how stressed and anxious they are about living in flesh prisons. And I really appreciate that a lot. The Unspeakable song, Totally Effed, has some of the best vocal performances I've heard in anything. Even though it has a really annoying speak songy bridge at one point, I really, really love how everyone gives it their all in that production. And one song that I don't see a lot of people talking about, even though it's probably in my top three songs of the show, the reprise of Mama Who Bore Me. The first version of Mama Who Bore Me is very soft, sweet, single acoustic guitar, some violin, and Lea Michele singing very softly and sweetly. It reminds me a lot of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. That's it. And it's about, you know, the anxieties of being a woman and having a body and things like that. Until after the scene where her mother kind of blows it off and says, the stork. The reprise of Mama Who Bore Me, which is only a few minutes after the first one, is this angry, biting version of the song with the exact same lyrics that's always performed beautifully by the cast of women in all the shows I've seen, and danced with this like pounding, like they're stomping on the floor to the beat. And it's such an incredible inversion of what was previously like a wistful song, like the Disney I Want song. And the reprise is just so, so good.
Very good summation of some of the incredible music in the show. I am offended by you. I'm offended by you not liking the speak singing bridge in Totally Effed, because that was my solo in my most recent show choir's performance.
Wait, seriously?
Yeah.
Oh my god, I'm a terrible person. Oh, oh my god.
Okay, I'm not actually offended.
No, I'm sad now. Oh, I love you so much, Quinn, and I'm very, very sad. I just
It's a beautiful performance. To wrap this up, we've had a lot of serious conversation about the music and the content of this show and how dark it is. I just wanted to hear some closing thoughts about why you think that this show is so dark. And, like, if you think it's necessary, why it is necessary, and why that this kind of thing, like, you could scale back the show and it would still emotionally resonate with people, but they could decide to go all the way. And why do you think that is?
I've never read the original German text or any adaptations thereof of the original Spring Awakening. On one hand, I really want to believe that they were being faithful to that adaptation, which is a terrible justification for doing terrible things, but at least there's a little bit of basis for that. On the other hand, there's so much like extreme culture today where like things need to go as far as they can in order to be so intense. In the 60s, Psycho was a really intense movie and people were blown away by it, but today it's rather trite. And now there's movies, especially in the horror scene, where like there's movies I don't even want to say the names of because I think they go too far and they're like obscene and upsetting and don't have any right to exist. I feel like Spring Awakening and a lot of other pieces of media have fallen to that culture of we need to be more extreme in order to make ourselves more culturally relevant and also to justify the emotions we're trying to bring to the audience. Again, a lot of emotions in the show I don't believe are justified because of that, but also I think they tried. And I still love the show. I still try to forget the bad parts of the show and just feel the fuzzy feelings I have about feeling like a teenager again, listening to this and wanting to lash out against the patriarchy and parents and adults and things like that. It's still not okay to have these kinds of things in a show. I don't feel like it's justified, although I do think the ending, again, the fact that they give the male protagonist a better arc than anybody else in the show is problematic, but at least they give Melchior a really good arc as he sings Those You've Known at the end of the show. Which, by the way, I really appreciate the fact that they wrote Those You've Known about having the ghosts of Venla and Moritz sing to him, and then they realize this is his song, so they go back and wrote All That's Known, the third song in the show, on the soundtrack at least, as his I Want song. And I really appreciate that they gave him an arc like that. But again, they only gave the male protagonist of the show an arc like that. I think the ending of the show is at least vague enough, not vague plot-wise, but vague meaning-wise, with the Song of Purple Summer, which is just poetry, even though it's not very, you know, explicit about what it's talking about. It's about growing up, moving on, being a person. And ooh, something I didn't even mention earlier, which is embarrassing because I prepared points about this. Elsa, one of my favorite characters in the show, for reasons I can't actually quite explain. Her function in the show is she is one of the women that went to school with everyone else. And at one point they talk about, where's Elsa? I don't know. She ran off with some, like, artist or something, and she's been living alone, really ran away from home or something. And she sings a few lines of a few songs and has Blue Wind to herself, which is one of the most incredible songs on the soundtrack. And my favorite thing about her is that, first of all, I've dated several people like like her, so I have that going for me, which is nice. And second, there's the concept that all of these people in this school, in this town, are going through things that they're scared of and terrified of. But then there's this one other person that just ran away. Huh, okay. When she comes back during Don't Do Sadness / Blue Wind, whenever she's doing her monologue before her song, she talks about living in this artist commune with a man who tries to kill her. And to me, she signifies the things that, like, the adult of the group, the people that are in your group and you look at and you think, how are they so far advanced from where I am, and how are they surviving doing these genuinely horrible things? Yeah, I have teenage angst. This is terrible. This is bad. But oh my God, she was almost killed. What is happening? And to me, she signifies the looming terribleness of death, and the fact that even though no matter how you feel, things are even going to be worse after the fact. And B, she signifies the people that you don't know how to reconcile in your head as people being your age or younger and being as self-sufficient or successful, or, like, she broke out of the town. That is what's good about her. But now she's in a really scary spot, and is it worth it? I don't know. You look at people who are, oh, I don't know, a few years younger than you, doing really great Broadway podcasts and having shows on Relay FM and doing really great solidly mediocre shows, and you think about, you know, how are these people able to do these things on your plane? And how are they able to survive with much more going on than you do? And to me, that's what Elsa signifies in the show, and I really appreciate her presence. And again, she's the person that starts singing the Song of Purple Summer, so she has a little bit of an arc in that I'm here, I'm gonna keep singing about moving on too. And it's like a very minor arc, and again, I just love her and how she sings on the soundtrack, but she has a little bit of an arc there, and I can appreciate that as well. But again, they need more arcs for more people, and Venla as a ghost does not have an arc.
Have you noticed that every time we record a podcast it becomes about that?
I've got to throw in a compliment to you at some point.
So unfortunately, at this point, we're pretty much out of time. So we're going to go to the lightning round.
Final judgments.
What?
That was a Flophouse joke. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. I never know what you're on about. All right, lightning round. Favorite song?
Don't Do Sadness.
All right. Favorite line?
Elsa's story about living in the artist commune. Because I don't have specific lines in front of me, but to me, that is the one that really hits me. Wait, no. Hang on. No, I gotta think. Crap. Because I'm thinking line of dialogue, but I can think line of a song, too. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
the first time they sing about singing the song of Purple Summer, because it's so intense. And even, yeah, it doesn't mean anything. What is the song of Purple Summer? I don't know. But the way they sing it and the place it is in the show really hits me.
Favorite character?
Venla. No. Elsa. Yeah, it's got to be Elsa because of everything I just said. She is this like wonderful minor character that pops up at a few key points in the play and drives home a point that the rest of the show doesn't.
Who would you recommend see this show?
Any teenager or anybody who is still feeling that way. Like, this is musical therapy.
If you have angst, go see Spring Awakening.
If you have angst, 9 out of 10 doctors recommend. Ask your doctor if Spring Awakening is right for you.
And finally, if you could combine this with any other musical, which one would you pick and why?
This has already been done somewhere, but I would combine Spring Awakening with Grease because I feel like all the ridiculous things that happen in both shows in a way that are relatively outlandish and intense, they pair well with each other. And they're teens, like, discovering what's going on, even though Grease is much more lighthearted and in many other ways than Spring Awakening. They're both teens discovering things. And yes, this has been done before. I'm sure we'll have a video to this in the show notes. I'll send you, Quinn. It is somebody doing Spring Awakening characters singing Grease songs.
Oh,
and the juxtaposition is great.
I've seen that. That's so good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Incredible choices. Brian, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. It means a lot that I get to be a Broadway geek on your podcast with you, especially after listening to all your other episodes. Oh, my God. I cannot wait to have my words and my musical of choice be a part of your pantheon.
And thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Corner of the Sky. You can find us on Twitter at COTS Podcast or online at theincomparable.com/COTS. You can also find us in Apple Podcasts, where it would be cool if you left us a review before we're all totally...